And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, I'm right here.
And our good friend Alex from the other radio show. Say hi, Alex.
Hello, everybody.
We are actually in a car in Pennsylvania, and we're on our way to prison. I made that sound a little cheery because, well, we're trying to stay in a good mood. Just to be clear, none of us are going to prison to stay, at least. Alex and I are going to visit a friend of ours who you may have heard of on the other radio program, the other radio program being Off the Hook, which airs on WBAI on Wednesday nights. Our friend is Virgil Griffith. He has been sent to Allenwood for a number of years as a result of an unauthorized trip he made to North Korea. Alex, maybe Alex is his lawyer too, by the way, and also Alex is a member of the hacker community. Maybe quickly, Alex, you could explain to me how you went from being a computer hacker to a lawyer who represents some of the most interesting people in the world.
That's a good question. You know, I started out hanging out with you guys back in the mid '90s, going to the 2600 meetups and the city over in the Citigroup building. And that's really, I say this all the time to people, I feel like my misspent youth as a hacker is really what has propelled my legal career in so many ways. I have so much to thank for being part of the hacker community, and I started my journey there, and so really have been dealing with cybersecurity and information security for just about 30 years now, if you can believe it, if you think that I started when I was about 15. But I went to Stony Brook, and then I went to Vermont Law School, and then I wound up combining these two skill sets together, my background in cybersecurity and sort of the hacker culture, and wound up working in a lot of interesting places like the Army JAG Corps, then some counterterrorism cybersecurity research, then in the intelligence community with CIA, then private practice. I'm now with Kroll & Mooring, a big AmLaw 100 firm where we represent some of the biggest companies and, like you said, some of the most interesting people in the world, people like Virgil Griffith. And prior to joining Kroll, I was also the acting chief information security officer of the NFL. So kind of going full circle back as the security practitioner and the lawyer. And really through 2600 and that camaraderie and that community, that's where I met Virgil Griffith, and unfortunately, we are visiting him in federal prison today because of he pleaded guilty to a sanctions violation back in September of 2021. I wasn't actually part of the actual trial defense team, but we were helping out in the back end on technical issues and issues I had to deal with sanctions. And then in April of 2022, Judge Castell of the Southern District of New York had actually sentenced Virgil to 5 years and 3 months in federal prison. So it's unfortunate, very, very unfortunate, but that's whom we are on our way to see.
It's interesting because what Virgil allegedly did was explain cryptocurrency to North Koreans, which violated sanctions, and I've known Virgil for many years. No, I know he wouldn't ever do anything that was harmful to anyone, but he will answer people's questions because, as any hacker would do, any decent hacker, he would spread knowledge of how something works. And I've been to North Korea myself. It's a fascinating place to go to. I feel I have to, of course, say that it's a terrible regime. Yes, we all know it's a terrible regime, but it's still a fascinating place to go to, and anybody who is curious will have some kind of a desire to see what that is like, and Virgil, I know, could not resist. I talked with him about this before he went. He made the mistake of asking for permission, and when I went, you didn't need permission. Donald Trump decided that he was going to impose a ban on Americans traveling to North Korea. So because of this Trump decree, Virgil was violating the law when he went there without permission. He was surprised when he wasn't granted permission, because what he was doing was so innocent, going to a cryptocurrency conference in North Korea. I mean, that just sounds fascinating in and of itself. And while he was there, they a couple of people, when you say they, you know, North Koreans aren't a monolithic mass. It was basically some individuals asking him some basic questions about cryptocurrency, nothing you couldn't find on the internet. And he was basically answering questions, but not anything to a technical degree. But when you say that, and when you have a judge who doesn't understand the technology, it can sure sound bad. It can sound like you're helping North Korea to destroy the world.
I think it's also worth pointing out, I think we forget this when we're recounting what was going on, the context, the entirety of business and promotional advertising world was a buzz about cryptocurrency, the promise of trading markets and new possibilities with cryptocurrency. So at the time, everyone was sharing and talking about cryptocurrency. There's even lawsuits now because of the FTX collapse and the fall-on effects on the investors and funds that provided capital for those fledgling crypto exchanges to exist at all. And there's a real resentment because there was so much froth and excitement around cryptocurrency. And for us, it was really great to be in proximity of someone who understood it, but kind of saw through a lot of the, at the time, the just outlandish, I would say even like 90s bubble era type explosion of excitement around this technology.
Yeah, you know, when you mention a resentment, you know, I think that hits the nail on the head. The judge really seemed to resent Virgil, treating him kind of like a smart aleck. And I've noticed, you know, a lot of people look upon hackers with that kind of resentment because they feel that they know too much, or that they're, you know, the smart people, by the way, is a cop ahead of you, Alex. Yep. I don't know, there's this resentment towards people that understand the technology that they don't understand. And again, you know, this is something that Virgil is more than happy to explain to people, and unfortunately it's that that honesty, that innocence that got him into trouble. We kind of knew that and I think that truck is going to get in your way there, Alex, so maybe give him some space. Yeah, we want to make it to prison safely. But when the FBI asked to talk to Virgil when he was in New York, he went without a lawyer, which was a very bad idea. But he thought he had nothing to hide. Why do I need a lawyer? It was that kind of naivete that made him an easy target for the FBI, and they certainly did target him. He thought he was doing something good. He thought he was helping the FBI by showing them the North Korean newspapers he brought back and explaining to them everything he saw, answering all of their questions, because that is how he is. You know, so many people wrote letters in support of Virgil. I don't think the judge read a single one of them. The judge simply sentenced him with the utmost hostility.
Yeah, I think a couple of points I want to make about Virgil's case, too. I think you're absolutely right that we're talking about somebody who is he's part of the hacker community. He's somebody who shares knowledge. This is just what we do. You know, we answer questions. We figure things out. We don't keep things secret. think about the title of Virgil's talk. It was blockchain and peace, right? You know, it was kind of like a riff on War and Peace, right? It was blockchain and peace, and the things that he was talking about were eminently Googleable, right? Eminently Googleable. This is stuff that, you know, kind of basic fundamental information as I understand it, right? So a couple of things about this, you know, when Judge Castell sentenced him, it was at the bottom actually of the plea agreement. Now, you know, you can look at it. He was pretty harsh. He came down. He brought the hammer down for sure on Virgil. He said some not so nice things at the sentencing hearing, but he did believe that he was a promising young man who had a lot more to offer the world. Now, you know, a lot of the government has come down like a ton of bricks on Virgil, and I think part of the reasoning for it is because he went to a regime that the U.S. government has not had a great deal of success in dealing with over the last few years. I mean, North Korea has been a hostile regime as well as a criminal enterprise. They've been up to no good in various places around the world, including the United States, stealing, laundering cryptocurrency, doing all kinds of bad things. There was a Bangladesh central bank hack that actually wound up resulting in about, I think it was $88 or $85 million being stolen from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. There's actually still litigation about that cybersecurity incident from, I think it was 2016. So the North Koreans have been really up to no good. And if you think about, and you look about, and one of the things, by the way, I teach this stuff at King's College London. I'm a professor of law there. And I teach through the great hacks. One of the great hacks is the Sony hack, the Bangladesh Bank hack, all of these North Korean hacks. And you look at the remedies that have fallen into place, or the remedies that we have tried to utilize in the wake of these incidents, and they are wholly inadequate, you know, both at law and as a form of justice. Nothing has been done to the North Koreans, you know, for this Bangladesh bank hack, for the Sony hack. You know, we know perhaps who some of the individuals are on the North Korean side, but they're never going to be subject to U.S. justice. And that's a very frustrating thing for the government. So then you have...
I just wanted to point out as well, a lot of the funding, and I think this is really the crux of why the government just cannot let this go, a lot of those ill-gotten gains are going towards the development of proliferation of nuclear weapons. Yeah. Straight up. They're developing their rocket technology as they have been for years, back when they were getting missile and... other types of technology for propulsion from Iran and other undesirable regimes insofar as the U.S. is concerned. And I think that's really what's going on here, is that time after time, all this money is being taken, and it is not going to, you know, aid and development within their country. It is going to elites, and it is going to proliferation activities, which really bothers the U.S.
That's an absolute great point, and it sets up my next point, I think, perfectly, Kyle, because the U.S. government really can't do very much about that, right? We can sanction North Korea. That's only so effective, right, to be put on this naughty list. But then you have a U.S. person, somebody who's involved with cryptocurrency and involved with the Ethereum Foundation, go over as a senior person with the Ethereum Foundation, go over to North Korea and start talking about this stuff. And then here's the other really interesting thing about Virgil, too. He didn't keep this a secret. He was very public about going over to North Korea. And then when he came back, he self-reported to the U.S. Embassy in Singapore. Now, very often, what happens when you self-report, especially if you're an academic, and Virgil is somebody who holds a PhD from Caltech in, I believe, neuroscience and computation. So, you know, we're not talking about somebody who is a small mind here. We're talking about somebody who is, I think, quite frankly, one of the brightest people on the planet. And he had self-reported. Usually what happens when academics go back, at, you know, from a conference, let's say in Iran or whatever, self-report, the U.S. government will send them a caution letter, a warning letter, saying, all right, well, thank you for telling us you did that. That's very, very bad. Don't do it again. Now, what happened with Virgil is the total opposite. They prosecuted him. They charged him essentially with a sanctions violation. And they really bit down hard. And if you look at how ineffective we have been at pursuing justice with respect to all these North Korean incidents and breaches, well, it can begin to look a lot like Virgil may be a proxy for that type of anger, and he may be bearing the brunt of that retribution when, quite honestly, for those of us, and Emmanuel, you can speak to this, those of us who know Virgil know that he is anything but a North Korean sympathizer. This is somebody who believed in American exceptionalism, believed in American hegemony, if you want to phrase it like that, but he was a real patriot, I think, kind of, you know, almost weirdly patriotic before all of this happened.
Yeah, and when he did self-report, we hung out with him the night after. He talked to the FBI, again, without a lawyer, very ill-advised. He basically said that they told him, yeah, this isn't a big deal. Maybe you'll get some kind of a letter saying don't do that again. But there's no real possibility of prosecution of any sort. And that's where the matter dropped, or it seemed to drop, at least for a few months. And it wasn't until later in the year when he was visiting his family on Thanksgiving. He was coming from Singapore, which is where he lived. He basically was going back to, I believe, Alabama, and transferring in California. They arrested him at the airport on his way to see his family on Thanksgiving. That is how they operate. And from that day, he basically has been in one form or another under lock and key. That's the way they treated him before his trial or sentencing, because he was forced to plead guilty because a trial would have opened him up to even more time in prison. But he was basically held to the strictest standards. And I know there was one case where he was his other lawyers wanted to be paid, and they told him to pay him through money through a cryptocurrency account. And because he accessed or had somebody access the cryptocurrency account, the judge said this is a violation of your conditional what's the right phrase? Release?
On bail. Yeah, he was on bail at the time.
So. Okay, so it was a violation of the bail conditions, and they threw him in prison for paying his lawyer. Rather than just, you know, have some kind of a an understanding as to what it was that was being done here. He was following the instructions of his lawyer. But, you know, ridiculous things like this just kept happening. They kept looking for any excuse to keep him locked up, when he really should have been with his family awaiting trial.
Yeah, that was a really unfortunate situation. What had happened there was the summer of 2021. He was not allowed to use a computer, so he came up with this plan, really, where his family would access the computer, would tell them what to do, and they would read him the information, this sort of ridiculous convoluted system for continuing to do work and whatnot. But he needed to liquidate some of his cryptocurrency holdings in order to pay his lawyers. And based on the communications that, you know, his prior law firm had sent to the judge about this, they said, well, you know, they thought it would be okay to use the same type of protocol, and didn't ask the judge for permission first. So when he went to access his Coinbase account, which was a restricted account, Coinbase then, I believe, likely, I don't know the exact chain of events that would happen, so I'm speculating here to a certain extent, but presumably Coinbase then contacted FBI, who contacted DOJ, who then made a motion to have his bail revoked before Judge Castell. Like I said before, this is a very tough judge, very no-nonsense judge. He could probably not have drawn a stricter judge. And if you compare sort of the shenanigans that have been going on in the SBF case, right? This is the case of Sam Bankman-Fried, who ran FTX, and he's also out on bail right now over in California, and he had been monkeying around and contacting witnesses, perhaps, I think, on Signal, and using a VPN at his home, and he's in front of Judge Kaplan. Judge Kaplan, by the way, is the judge.
My Judge Kaplan?
That's right, your Judge Kaplan. This is the Judge Kaplan that oversaw the 2600 versus Motion Picture Association of America case back in 99 and 2000, I think it was, right?
Wasn't Judge Kaplan also just involved in a Trump case?
Yeah, I think he was. I think he was involved in a Trump case as well as, I think, that Chevron case. He's been involved in a lot of really interesting cases, and he's been around the Southern District for a very long time. But the point being, though, is that Judge Kaplan did not revoke the bail of SBF. Judge Castell would have. Judge Kaplan did not. He set stricter conditions in place, and SBF is still out on bail. If Virgil had drawn a different judge, I think we would be in a totally different situation. We may not even be having to make this trip out to visit him.
Well, let's go to the present. It's the end of May, and we are visiting Virgil. It's the first time I'm going to be seeing him, I guess, since that night after he went to the FBI. Can you tell us something about how he's been holding up in this prison, which I believe is Allenwood, Pennsylvania?
That's right. Virgil is in the Allenwood Low facility because his offense is technically a national security offense. He has to be in a low security facility. He was not eligible for a camp, which would be even lower than low. But he's been doing all right, I have to say. He still maintains his resilience. He's keeping busy. We talk all the time. He's very much active. And I think what just bothers him the most about this is the length of the sentence and the fact that he's just unproductive. Feels very unproductive in that environment. But it was not always this comfortable either. When he moved over to Allenwood, it was a really, really difficult time because, number one, he was over in MDC, which is the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, which is not a nice place at all. That's a really, really tough place to be, and that's where he was for quite a while. And before that, he was in the MCC, the Metropolitan Correction Center, which has been known regularly for years as literally a hellhole. And that's the facility that's connected. It's not connected directly to the Southern District of New York, but that's where people who are going on trial in the Southern District are held. And it became most famous several years ago as the place where Jeffrey Epstein was detained, and depending upon whatever you believe, he either killed himself or was killed in that facility.
He met his end in that facility, yes.
Yeah, that's probably the most accurate way, I think, of putting it. Yeah, the least controversial, I guess, way of putting it. But when Virgil had moved over to Allenwood from MDC, we all saw this as a positive move, going into a low-security place where he can create a routine and not be around lots of other really, really bad people. I mean, he saw some pretty horrendous things over in MDC in Brooklyn. But what had happened is, and this is a sort of ironic consequence of something that President Biden did. So one of the first things President Biden did when he took office was he closed a lot of these immigration facilities that were housing immigration detainees because they were they had horrendous conditions. So we can't fault him for doing that. However, a lot of those detainees then had to go into separate federal facilities, of which Allenwood was one, because it had an immigration unit associated with it. So because of that, there weren't a lot of spaces available for Virgil to be housed. So for really about the first 100 days that Virgil was in Allenwood, he was actually in something called the SHU, or the Special Housing Unit. And that's essentially solitary confinement for a very long period of time. And that was really difficult, really, really tough transition, and not something I think anybody would ever want to go through. Those were pretty dark times. And I just, you know, I think we're all just very thankful that he's out of there, and we hope that he never has to go back to that special housing unit, which what I've heard is very much like a dungeon. So it's not been easy. It's not been easy by any means.
So, Alex, you've visited Virgil before. This is my first time. I've been to federal prison visiting people in the past. I haven't in a number of years, so I don't know how much things have changed. But I do know they have been absurdly strict on certain things And yeah, I'm going in there with virtually nothing in my pocket, so that's I can't imagine really anything that they would talk to me about having that I shouldn't have. But can you give us an idea of some of the more absurd things that they've come up with in the past?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to bring anything inside this place. I mean, you basically just have to have your license on you. You can't have your cell phone on you. The last time I went to visit Virgil was just maybe about a month ago. I had to go back and forth to my car in the parking lot about four or five times. Because every time I went back up, there was another thing that was wrong. Right? You know, it was either I was bringing something in that I couldn't bring. One time was my fault. I forgot to leave my cell phone in the car. Then I forgot to take my belt off. I wasn't allowed to have my belt in there. Then they recognized that I was wearing a color shirt that I probably shouldn't be wearing.
Wait. What do you mean, a color shirt? What? I have a shirt on. Is it the wrong color?
Let me see your color shirt. Now, your shirt should be okay. My shirt was kind of like a beigeish tan, and they didn't like that because it could be confused with, you know, something an inmate wears. So they said, you know, you should probably take that shirt off. And I had to go in there with, you know, just a T-shirt on. And this isn't, you know, peculiar to Allenwood either. I got to tell you, one of the first times I went to go see Virgil at the MCC when he was awaiting trial, the Metropolitan Correction Center in Manhattan, I'd never visited anybody there before. You know, I focused mostly on cybersecurity law and technology and things like that, not really criminal law. And so I rode my bicycle down to the court, and I'm going through the processing to get in. And the guard said to me, he said, "Oh no, you know, it was a hot summer day too." He said, "You know, you can't go in here wearing shorts. You can't wear shorts inside here." And so, okay, right? You know, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. It was also during COVID, and so you know, you got to find a pair of pants. So I could have gone all the way back to my apartment in Westwood. They said, "You know, look, this happens to a lot of people. Just go wander around Chinatown. Go find a shop and buy some pants." So I did that. Nothing was open. I'm wandering around for like an hour and a half. And then I realized, you know, I'm on Canal Street. I have an architect friend of mine who lives on Canal Street, called up his girlfriend, wound up borrowing a pair of pants from him just to get into the MCC. Now, this guy, Martin, of course, it turns out he was on a massive diet, and his pants had really shrunk. So I go in there wearing these extremely tight pants. So it was, you know, there's always something. The way in which Virgil's family has phrased it to me is that when you're going into these facilities, you're dealing with people that, you know, they can be very pleasant, they can be very nice, but they are bureaucrats, and they are the perfect bureaucrats, and they will follow, you know, these rules to an absolute T. And if it means sending you back to your car 10 times before you get it right, well, that's what they have to do. And it's really, really restrictive. If you're not a lawyer, you can't bring in any papers, anything. It's pretty rough.
All right. So I know, Alex, you also told me that at one point, the way it's set up, you meet with the inmate and you're able to buy them things at a vending machine. They're not able to buy things themselves, but you can buy overpriced items, which are actually better quality than what they have every day. And obviously to do that, you have to bring cash in to feed the vending machines. But there was a time when they didn't like the denomination of cash that you brought with you?
Yeah, that's correct. The last time I was there, I mean, they didn't allow me to bring in a 20. Now, every other time that I've seen Virgil, which is a number of times, they've always let me bring in a 20. And in fact, one of the vending machines there will give you change for a 20. It'll split it. So it's designed to give you change for a 20. But that day they said, "Nope, sorry, you know, a 5 is the largest denomination that you can bring in." So then I had to go back to the car, redeposit that $20 bill, come back with a huge number of quarters that I had from other visits. So they make it difficult. But also, about the vending machines, there's just something that's just kind of sad about it to me, because it really is just such abject taking advantage of the situation that bothers me about this, because you have these inmates, they don't eat very well. They want to buy some of this vending machine food, which by our standards is not great food. It's the only opportunity they have to eat better food. It's extraordinarily overpriced. I mean, this is classic price gouging. I mean, you'll spend $6-$7 on a muffin, and you have to insert all $6-$7 generally, one quarter after quarter after quarter after quarter, just one after another. And the inmates themselves aren't even allowed to see what's in the vending machines. They're not allowed to go back into that area. So only the families can do it. And you'll see today, Emmanuel, that, you know, you're dealing with families there that don't have a lot of means. You know, they're not well-off people, and they want to do the right thing for their loved one who's in there, and so they're forced to spend, you know, $6-$7 on a muffin, or, you know, $3 for a Pepsi. And it really does, it breaks my heart to see this money being pried out of the hands of the families of these people that unfortunately find themselves in there.
Wow. Well, that is something to, it brings back memories, because I have seen that before, but it wasn't so stringent when I last visited somebody where they looked at the denomination of cash that you had with you. I'm bringing a roll of quarters. I hope that's acceptable, but who knows? It's going to be harder for us because we won't have a car to put things in, because Kyle's not on the list, so he is going to be heading to a coffee shop somewhere. And also, Alex's dog is here in the car with us, so he's going to be babysitting the dog. So we've got that going on. So if we get denied for whatever reason, we won't be able to put the denied item into a car. We'd have to, I guess, bury it outside or something if we want. Virgil's calling. Pick it up.
This call. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from
Virgil Griffin.
This call will be recorded and subject to monitoring at any time. To accept this call, press 5. To block this call and all future calls, press 7. To reject this call, hang up. You may begin speaking now.
Virgil.
Hey, Virgil.
Hey.
Hi, Virgil.
Hello, I just want to make sure you're coming.
Yeah, we're on our way, man. We're on our way.
We're okay. On the car.
We've got... No, I mean, it's fine. I was just concerned that you wouldn't be getting your money's worth.
No, we're on our way. We are about 45 minutes away without any stops. But, you know, we'll see you soon, man. All right?
All right, see you soon. Okay, bye-bye.
All right. You know, it's so easy to hit 7 by accident. You hit 5 to accept and 7 to deny forever.
Yeah.
And that, wow. I'm not familiar with that kind of calling system. In the past, it was always just collect, or they had, you know, I guess he's using up some kind of unit system.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, these are calls that Virgil is paying for. And he only has a certain amount of minutes per month in order to call. You know, we will generally speak about various things almost every day. But then towards the end of the month or so, I get worried because I won't hear from him. And then we'll realize, well, he probably just ran out of minutes.
Wow. And this is going to be going on for the next few years, unfortunately. One of the brightest minds we know being subjected to this nonsense. Just because people don't understand what was going on, what it was all about. We're going to take a break now. We're going to pick this up after our visit, which hopefully takes place today here in Pennsylvania. Okay, it is the next day. Alex and I went into the prison and had quite an adventure. You want to take us through the initial part, Alex, because I want to tell the story about what happened to me as I was entering.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we showed up at Allenwood. We had to deal with this logistical issue of, well, you know, I've got my dog in the car. We can't bring any cell phones in. We can't bring anything in other than your identification. So we had to figure out, well, how do we get back, right? And how do we get back? We had a prearranged time for Kyle to return, But sometimes you get kicked out ahead of time. Sometimes they shut things down early. So we had to do some weird planning. We got in there. We filled out the various forms that you need to fill out, even though you're already on a visitor list. We went through the metal detector, and I think that's where things started to go a little wrong for you, right, E?
Well, okay, I was prepared for things to be very, very hostile, but they were actually very nice. The woman at the desk couldn't have been friendlier. She already knew you because you'd been there multiple times before. We filled out the forms. We had the right ID. I had a driver's license with me. But I thought it'd be wise for me to have two forms of ID. So I had my passport card as well. I also thought maybe, you know, it'd be good to have a credit card just in case, you know, we couldn't get in touch with Kyle afterwards. Keep in mind, we couldn't bring our cell phones. There are no pay phones. There was no way to call Kyle to say, hey, we're ready to go. What if the car broke down or something? What if we had to, you know, get an emergency ride or something? So I figured a credit card would be a good thing to have. Had a AAA card. I don't know why I had that. Maybe, you know, in case the car, I'm always thinking the car is going to break down. So AAA card might have helped. I also had my health insurance because, well, you know, what if I fell down after the car broke down? I don't know. But those were the things I thought made sense. But what they told me was that I wasn't allowed to bring any of those ID cards or plastic cards with me, and that I needed to put them back in the car. Now, we didn't have the car because, well, actually, we said, Kyle, stay for 10 minutes before leaving in case you know, they tell us we have to put something back in. But it took longer than 10 minutes. That was the problem. And I realized this was going to be close. Maybe Kyle is still in the parking lot. But I felt that running out of a prison probably wasn't the best look. So I walked out of the prison and looked for Kyle, and now he was gone. So I didn't know what to do. You know, I had these extra bits of ID that I certainly didn't want to discard. I needed these. You know, discarding a passport ID is not a good idea, but I couldn't go in with them. So they wouldn't take them for whatever reason. So I was just walking around the parking lot looking like I knew where I was going, because I didn't want to be walking aimlessly around the prison either. That's not a good look. Couldn't really put it in back of somebody's tire, you know, because they're going to leave probably, and that's not good. So I walked around the border of the parking lot next to the woods that surrounds the whole place, and I saw a lamppost. And that lamppost had this little gap between the concrete and the actual metal fixture. And I was able to slide the four cards in there. They were just visible. You could see them. They just stuck up a little bit, and kind of slide the metal part tightly onto them. And that's what I did. I just put them there and just walked back to the prison, looking like I knew what I was doing, because I sure didn't. And then I rejoined you. And I said a little prayer that nobody saw what I had just done, or nobody would be wandering around there and would find my four cards and commit credit card fraud and identity theft and whatever else they could possibly do with those forms of ID that I left behind.
You know, Emmanuel, it's amazing. These things always seem to happen to you. And this one really was of your own making, I have to say. You know, you didn't have to bring those cards with you. I told you just bring your ID. And, you know, still, you have to be contrarian. You got to test the system in one way or another. So what happened next, right? So then we go through the metal detector again. Everything is great. You know, she's looking through all my papers, all the things that I needed to bring into Virgil, verified that I was an attorney, even though she knew me, et cetera, et cetera. And then we got this stamp on our hand, right? And it's a stamp that's only visible in blacklight. And it's a stamp that says a word on your hand. Do you remember what the word was, Emmanuel?
Actually, I don't. It's on my hand right now, probably still, but I don't remember what the word was. Was it flea or something like that?
It was bath, B-A-T-H, right? And so the purpose of this is, so anytime you're going through a secure door or facility, they have a black light, and people that are allowed out of the prison have this stamp on their hand. And you put your hand underneath that black light, and they know that it's okay for you to go through that particular door. So they check when you're going in, and they check when you're going out. It's a very weird process.
Well, now, what would have happened if I had gone to the bathroom while visiting Virgil and washed my hand and that word was no longer on? Would I be compelled to stay in that prison?
Well, that's a good question, actually, because I did, in fact, do that Remember, I left you guys alone, and I went to use the facilities. I dutifully washed my hands.
You washed the secret word off your hand, and I'm the contrarian one.
Well, I wasn't thinking about it as I was washing my hand. And then I was wondering on the way out, is this thing still going to be there? And it was still completely visible. Apparently, soap has no effect on whatever substance they use, probably full of carcinogens that they use to stamp your hands.
So is my hand going to say bath for the rest of time?
I think you very well may have something on your hand for a little while. It'd be interesting to check, if you have a black light at home, determine how long this thing actually stays on your hand.
I do have a black light, so I'm going to check, and we'll see how long this bath lasts on my hand. But anyway, this isn't the important part. The important part is getting to see Virgil. And interestingly enough, we were able to see him in a private room because, well, you're a lawyer, you were getting a legal visit, and apparently I was able to piggyback onto that legal visit. So for the entire period we were there, we were in this little separate room while everybody else was in this big room where all the family members and all the prisoners were chatting. It was very, you know, calm and polite, and people were going to vending machines, getting snacks for their inmate relatives or friends. And we got to hang out and discuss legal strategy.
Yeah, it was really great. It was actually, I was pleasantly surprised that they all let us into this room. I thought that this was going to be some logistical nightmare where my legal visit was going to have to be first, and then we'd have to go out and then back in. But they actually made it pretty easy, you know, and everybody was very, very nice. And everyone there is always pretty nice. I've had some people question me in the past. One of the guards told me a couple of months ago when I was there, and I just showed up in a T-shirt. He said, you know, let me ask you this. I don't want you to take this wrong. Are you a real lawyer? So I said, yes, I'm a real lawyer. I said, you know, here's the printout from my bar admission. And while he says, well, you know, I'm only asking because you don't look like a lawyer to me. You don't look like a typical lawyer.
That's a compliment, I think.
Well, that is exactly what I said to him. I said, well, you know, I will take that as a compliment. That's fine, you know. And then we proceeded to have a legal visit. But they know me there now. So they're quite friendly. But once we got to see Virgil, you know, what was the first thing we did, right? I mean, he gave me a hug, and then I got to say, it was really, really touching to see this reunion between you and Virgil.
Well, I have to say, I was impressed by how well he looks. He looks like he's been keeping in shape. He certainly was engaged in the conversation. He is thinking of strategies. But he's also thinking of possibilities for new ideas involving technology. Basically, he's still Virgil, and that was the only thing I really could have hoped for.
I mean, it's hard to keep up with him, isn't it? I mean, he's always got something going on in his mind. He's always thinking. He's always got, I wouldn't want to say plotting. Plotting is the wrong word, I think, to use here. But he's got this brain of his that just won't stop working and synthesizing. And I think that's the real mark of genius here too, right? You know, you can be a great mathematician or you can be a great engineer, but unless you can synthesize different types of disciplines or ideas together, you know, that you're not really a genius. I think the genius really lies in the synthesis, and that's what you get with Virgil. And it's really amazing because we were talking about blockchain, we're talking about, you know, value, we're talking about zero knowledge proofs, we're talking about the history of cryptography, politics, China, Taiwan. It all seems to come together somehow in a coherent whole. It's an amazing opportunity, I think. And I say this all the time to his parents whenever I leave a meeting with Virgil. I'm always energized by it, and I'm always feeling really optimistic. He makes me feel good about myself. Excuse me. I get a little choked up even thinking about it because he's such an empathetic person that he puts himself above everybody else. And I think he makes you feel like a good person. But anyhow, I tell his father all the time that it's just such a privilege. I feel very privileged to be his friend and his lawyer and to have the opportunity to sit down with him for a couple of hours and chat because I am just so energized by those conversations. And on the one hand, it's also very emotionally draining too because I come out just despondent knowing that here's this guy who's going to be in this place until January 2026, and unless, you know, something else goes in his favor, and maybe that will be the case, but you know, he's just sort of languishing there. You know, he could be doing so much more for the world. But when you're there and you're in the room with him, he's doing a lot for you. It's a great conversation. It's a great time. What are your thoughts, E?
Well, I mean, it was just incredible. There was a point there where he was talking about Singapore and Malaysia and how Singapore could have been part of Malaysia but wasn't, and comparisons to Hong Kong and China and what the future with China and Hong Kong might be. And I just realized we must be the only people in here now or ever talking about world politics during a prison visit, and was just really unique and incredible and special. You know, he has a sense of humor. He has his interest in everything that's going on in the world, and creativity. Like, you know, I so rarely see, and I know a lot of really creative people.
The other thing that is amazing to me about Virgil is just the sense of resilience that he has. I mean, here's a guy, you know, we talked about this on the way in, about, and he's been through a hell of a lot, you know, going through, you know, being arrested in L.A., transported across the United States, and then been Metropolitan Detention Center, the Metropolitan Correction Center, where Epstein was, and then thrown into the SHU, the special housing unit at Allenwood, and having spent a long period of time there. You know, he says he's so resilient. He's there, he's thinking, he's doing. And to me, it's an example of the indomitable spirit of a human being, that no matter where he is, he's not going to be broken.
Yeah, certainly something that I can be inspired by. I think anybody going through adversity can be inspired by. If you're in a horrible situation like this, you can still be who you are. You can still be thinking of new things, learning new things, coming up with ideas. You know, the 2.5 hours went really, really fast.
Yeah, I'm so glad that it went off and you were able to meet and spend that time. Like, in his ambition and everything, excitement and enthusiasm is still coming through. And though he's sort of physically confined, it's not, you know, confining his thoughts and so forth and imagination, which that's a real boost for your morale in conditions and in situations like this. And especially having that visit, some outside contact after so long and so many different experiences along, you know, getting to this place. But it sounds just like it's going as well as it could. And him knowing that people are thinking of him and supporting him, or, you know, is bolstering that that morale and keeping him, you know, kind of looking ahead and thinking about possibilities and some of his ideas. And it certainly flew by for me. I mean, I spent like an hour at a coffee place with the dog, and then I was concerned maybe I wouldn't get the timing and be able to pick you guys up at the right time, and I was also a little worried. That's partly why I left. It was very hot. It was a very bright, clear day in the parking lot. And I didn't want to sit there with the car idling. I waited and then kind of pulled off because I wanted to make sure the dog wasn't like overheating. I wanted to get the air going. And then we just spent that hour. I really only just like turned my computer on, had some coffee. And then I was thinking what to do with the dog. And there was a small park across the street from the coffee place. But I had this idea. I was like, well, how about let's do what dogs do? What do dogs want to do? They want to go to a dog park, you know, hang out with other dogs. And I figured, okay, well, let me look at it. So that's all I did, is just I used the Wi-Fi there to figure out what to do for the next hour, because I wanted to be kind of on my way by 9:45 and maybe try to time it, because we had an agreed upon time after the meet and what we understood the ending of visitation would be. So in reality, I wrapped up at the dog park, had an incredible time with Cleo at the dog park, which was a really funny adventure in itself.
And you also discovered that Williamsport, the town that you had gone to, was the focal point for something else.
Yeah, it's so true. As I was approaching to get to the coffee shop, which I believe is in South Williamsport across the river, I noticed a ball field and the headquarters for the International Little League organization, which we watched a little bit of it, and it was pretty exciting last year, and I'm sure they're geared up for another World Series of Little League this year. But this is where it takes place, and they always talk about the city and the tradition. There's a big museum there, and it was so funny because it clicked. I was like, wait a minute, this Williamsport. Yeah, that's the name. And so here we were. I was like in a dog park that is adjacent to that entire ball field complex. And they had a great like bike trail along a raised train trestle that goes along the river. Just a lot of activity. You could go around this complex. There's like multiple soccer fields and tennis courts. It was huge. And that was just the park part. It wasn't part of the ball field facility. So I noodled around. I looked at it a little bit, but I didn't want to get too distracted. And we were mainly focused on the dog park, which was pretty vacant. We had the run of it, and a couple dogs showed up, and I went around to the tennis courts to find water. We were on our own little dog adventure, and I like dogs, so I got along with it.
Well, yeah, it's interesting, too, because we drove through Williamsport later and noticed that there was one intersection where every corner was a base, and there were statues of Little League players at every corner.
Yeah, the four corners of the streets were assembled as bases on a ball field, a bronze ball field.
I guess the pitcher, then, is in the middle of the intersection, technically.
Theoretically, yeah. Yeah, I think that's how that would work. So hopefully, maybe...
kids don't do that.
Maybe during parades only, they do the pitching.
Uh-huh. It reminds me, though, of the trip we took across the country on our way from Seattle to New York, where we drove through small towns, and every small town had something unique about it.
You find out.
And Williamsport is an example of that, with the International Little League and the site of the World Series every year.
Absolutely. Any part of this country, you wander into a place like, you know, unfamiliar territory, new part of the state or the county, you'll find out what they're about. You'll find out what they're known for, what they're proud of. And what attracts people to visit, maybe. And it's always cool to take that in and make connections. If you've seen something on TV or you're aware of a particular event that people celebrate in that area, you can kind of just be a part of it for an instant, the imagining of it is that much more vivid. If you see it again, or you're hearing about it, you'll remember, wow, okay, that was a cool town, or I know a little bit more about it than just what I saw on a production or on a game.
So, Alex, let's wrap up the visit and the fate of the cards that I had to leave hidden in a lamppost.
Well, you were really funny about that, actually, because, you know, as soon as you signed out of the visitor book, he had really hightailed it out there. He said, you know, I don't have much time. You know, he had to get out to this lamppost. I didn't know what was going on, and you didn't tell me where you had hid this stuff either.
Well, I didn't want to say out loud, by the way, I had to hide four of my vital cards inside a lamppost in the parking lot, because somebody might have overheard that. Sometimes in prison, people are trying to hear what other people are saying. And I didn't want anyone to start looking. I didn't want anyone to have any kind of intelligence whatsoever. I just basically hinted to you that, yeah, it didn't quite go as planned. And Kyle wasn't there. I wasn't able to give him the cards. So, you know, that's as much as I was able to tell you. And then on the way out, you were basically socializing with complete strangers, as you do. I really wanted to get to the cars to see if they were still there. So I had to sort of move a little bit fast.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just a affable, charismatic guy. You know, people gravitate towards me. I guess I can't help it. But it was really amusing to me to be trailing behind you and wondering where you hid these cards, because I knew they were hidden somewhere. And there are these giant rocks. I thought maybe did he have the strength to move one of those? No, it couldn't possibly have been one of those rocks.
Oh, I had the strength to move the rocks, but it would have been too obvious. That's the first place somebody would look, was under a rock.
Well, you're a lot stronger than you look, then. I'll put it that way. But you know, tying it all together, though, it made me think of this, because after you were able to get your cards out of the disused lamppost in the parking lot successfully, you know, and while Kyle was running...
Spoiler alert. You just gave away the ending.
Oh, wow.
I was going to have a big dramatic build-up to that. But okay, I'll tell the story after.
Well, on our other show, it's usually you who interrupts the narrative flow, so I got you back this time. How about that? in any event, but what struck me as really amazing, though, and sort of the end of this visit, was that while we were waiting for you, we were sitting out there in the hot sun, and Emmanuel had this idea, well, why don't we walk over into the grassy area, you know, where there are these trees, and we can stand in the shade. And as we did that, we walked a little bit farther back, and Emmanuel, you saw this tree, one of the most beautiful trees I've ever seen, just sitting right there. It's got to be at least 150, 160 years old. Massive tree trunk, healthy tree, just sitting there, and
And next to this prison, adjacent to this prison, it was just this absolute beauty, you know. And I think it, we were more receptive to that type of thing after meeting with Virgil. I think people, and hopefully the listeners will be able to tell that, you know, our attitudes are totally different after seeing him. In anticipation of seeing him, it was pretty somber. After seeing him, we appreciated the world in a different light.
Well, I mean, it's amazing, that tree that you mentioned. I think it's at least 200 years old. But, you know, a well-manicured lawn and just a very shady little spot next to the parking lot. But I was wondering, who is this for? Because certainly the prisoners can't appreciate this, and the people who are coming to visit just get into their cars as soon as they're done. They don't hang out in the field. The only people this is possibly for are people that are waiting for somebody who took the car with the dog to Williamsport and are coming back at a particular point in time. So certainly appreciated that being there.
I love that you were you're just emerging. I had no idea where you were coming from when I was parked, but that is so true. Coming from such a bleak, sort of bureaucratic, a cold, sort of austere environment, a very, very structured environment, and coming out of that, having been enthused with the conversation, I could see things being more vivid, being more appreciative that you're actually not in there in the same way. And it occurred to me actually before I left, seeing that same activity of correctional officers going in and out. And I was like, what must that be like? Your job is at a prison, so your life is, I go to prison all day long. I mean, that's got to wear on you. And I don't know that anybody, you know, everybody's really well suited for that, because I think it would drive me absolutely insane.
Well, it's interesting because when we came out of the prison, it was about 3 p.m., and I guess that's when there's a shift change, because we noticed, as Kyle said, all these people going in and coming out with backpacks and basically, you know, people who worked in the prison as guards or whatnot. And when we had come out, I'll tell how things turned out for me. I went directly to the lamppost where I'd hidden the cards, and I could actually see the cards from a distance because they stuck up a little bit. It's a good thing they did, too, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to lift them out. So if you were looking directly there, you would have seen something. So I went directly to it. Everything was there. Everything was fine. And I realized there was somebody sitting in the car right next to it probably saw me go to the lamppost and take something from there. And I figured, oh, it's just, you know, somebody who just visited someone. But after about 5 minutes, that person got out of the car, and I realized they were one of the prison employees, probably a prison guard, who saw me taking something out of a lamppost outside of prison. I don't know how suspicious that looked, or maybe just realized that this is what people do when they can't bring something in, or maybe he didn't even notice. I don't know, but it was awkward and weird, but it ended happily, at least that part did. But yeah, the whole thing was a surreal experience. You know, it always is when you visit somebody in prison, but I can't emphasize enough how important it is that people who are in prison retain that human contact. And Alex, I think you've been monumental as far as keeping that that hope alive for Virgil and just giving him so many opportunities to just think of new ways to get justice or to engage in projects in the future. And I just hope you realize how important that is.
You know, I do, and I have to say this, and I mean it sincerely. You know, I thank you for introducing me to Virgil, because it's a privilege to be his friend. I really mean that. He's an extraordinary human being, and you know, this is a friendship that will endure, I think, for the rest of our days.
And with that, we're going to bring this episode of Off the Wall to a close. It's been fun. It's been definitely interesting on this Memorial Day weekend when we're recording this. We will be back with who knows what next week. Kyle, thank you very much for being a part of this.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for letting me come along and join you in this this adventure, checking in on our friend.
And maybe next time you'll get to go into prison yourself.
I don't think the warden will allow.
I came out wrong, but yeah. And Alex, again, thank you for being a part of this and for driving.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to having you back again.
Good night.
Matthew.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.